Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5. My name is Lauren Corman. I'm your host here with Rob Moore co-hosting and doing the news. And we also have Carl Orzechowski in the studio doing the music for us today. Today's program, we're going to be featuring a double interview with Sheila Hamanica and Patrick Kwan, and we're going to be talking about racism within the animal rights movement and what we can do to address the problem. And before we jump into that, though, we're going to hear some news, and we're going to also hear a it's a press release of sorts from the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition, and they gave us their perspective on the Calgary Stampede and some of the recent events that have unfolded there. But over to you, Rob, with the news.
Thanks, Laura. In this week's news, police will not lay charges in the Stampede's horse death. Trey Arrow gets extradited. Vegetarians can save the world. And growing chicken nuggets without the chicken. First, an article from a while back from the Times Online. Rich vegetarians in Bombay are turning sections of their city into meat-free zones to the indignation of meat eaters barred from living there. I actually reported on this several months ago, but I thought it was great when they picked it up again. Housing complexes and whole neighborhoods in India's most cosmopolitan city are going vegetarian. Even on Malabar Hill, where foreigners and Indian millionaires live in mansions, some shops' owners refuse to stock meat products. 2 years ago, Jati Chedda moved into Ramkrupa Flats in South Bombay with her husband and was relieved to find the occupants of the 120 flats were all vegetarians. "We detest the smell of meat being cooked," she said. "Even omelets give off a disgusting aroma. My relatives would avoid coming to my house if my neighbors were non-vegetarian." Bhavesh Shah, a shopkeeper and a Jain, has thrown a cordon sanitaire around his housing complex in Breach Candy. "Our housing society asks new tenants to sign a declaration," he said. "If they're found cooking meat, they're thrown out." The Supreme Court has ruled that people who want to live in a community of like-minded people can prevent outsiders moving in. Last year, a regional Hindu nationalist party, Shiv Sena Group, stormed vegetarian buildings demanding admission for meat eaters, armed with Bombay duck, a strong-smelling dried fish. "People are free to choose their own lifestyle, but imposing it on your neighbors is wrong," said a party spokesman. Maybe we should talk about veggie communities at some point in the future. From canoe.ca, police will not lay charges in an ill-fated trail ride that ended in the deaths of 9 rodeo horses when they were spooked crossing a bridge and fell into the Bow River. The criminal code requires cruelty to animals to be willful before prosecution takes place, Calgary police said. The animals were part of a 200-strong herd of bucking horses being brought into Calgary from the Stampede Ranch for the start of the city's annual rodeo. The ride was ranged as part of Alberta's centennial. Professional cowboys and 20 people who paid $15,000 each to take part tried in vain to corral the stampeding horses. The Calgary Humane Society is investigating and has said it may lay charges under the Alberta Animal Protection Act. Next, from MSNBC.com, a court on Thursday ordered the extradition of suspected eco-terrorist Trey Arrow, one of the FBI's most wanted fugitives, to face firebombing charges in the United States. The 30-year-old Arrow, born Michael Scarpiti, is accused of participating in the 2001 firebombing of logging and cement trucks in Oregon. The FBI claims he is associated with the Earth Liberation Front, a group that has claimed responsibility for dozens of acts of destruction over the past few years. British Columbia Supreme Court Judge Christy Gill ruled that there was enough evidence against Arrow to have him extradited to face federal charges. His lawyer said he would appeal, a process that could take months. Arrow contends he won't get a fair trial in the U.S. because of the FBI's assertion that his alleged crimes were acts of terrorism. He faces federal charges in Oregon of using fire to commit a felony, destroying vehicles used in interstate commerce, and using incendiary devices in a crime of violence. The charges carry up to a combined 80 years in prison. From fizorg.com, global warming could be controlled if we all became vegetarians and stopped eating meat, according to British physicist Alan Calvert. Writing in this month's Physics World, Calvert calculates that the animals we eat emit 21% of all the carbon dioxide that can be attributed to human activity. We could therefore slash man-made emissions of carbon dioxide simply by abolishing all livestock. Moreover, there would be no adverse effects to health, and it would be an experiment that we could abandon at any stage. Worldwide reduction of meat production in the pursuit of the targets set in the Kyoto Treaty seems to carry fewer political unknowns than cutting our consumption of fossil fuels, he says. And from Canada.com, spotlights and a burning semi-trailer illuminated the Trans-Canada Highway last week as firefighters fought to extinguish flames while RCMP officers shot squealing injured pigs. A collision between two semi-units, one hauling about 200 hogs, occurred near Wolseley, about 100 kilometers east of Regina. A young girl, a passenger in one of the trucks, was taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Police said about half of the pigs died as a result of the crash, which happened when the truck loaded with the animals was rear-ended by another semi. Just another point about the transportation of livestock in this country. From Ascribe.org, experiments for NASA space missions have shown that small amounts of edible meat can be created in a lab, but the technology that could grow chicken nuggets without the chicken on a large scale may not just be a science fiction fantasy. In a paper in the June 29th issue of Tissue Engineering, a team of scientists, including University of Maryland doctoral student Jason Matheny, proposed two new techniques of tissue engineering that may one day lead to affordable production of in vitro, lab-grown meat for human consumption. It is the first peer-reviewed discussion of the prospects for industrial production of cultured meat. There would be a lot of benefits from cultured meat, says Matheny. For one thing, you could control the nutrients. For example, most meats are high in the fatty acid omega-6, which can cause high cholesterol and other health problems. With in vitro meat, you could replace that with omega-3, which is a healthy fat. Cultured meat could also reduce the pollution that results from raising livestock, and you wouldn't need the drugs that are used on animals raised for meat. The authors agree, though, it might take work to convince consumers to eat cultured muscle meat, a product not yet associated with being produced artificially. On the other hand, cultured meat could appeal to people concerned about food safety, the environment, and animal welfare, and people who want to tailor food to their individual tastes, says Matheny. The paper even suggests that meat makers may one day sit next to bread makers on the kitchen counter. The benefits could be enormous, Matheny says. The demand for meat is increasing worldwide. China's meat demand is doubling every 10 years. Poultry consumption in India has doubled in the last 5 years. With a single cell, you could theoretically produce the world's annual meat supply, and you could do it in a way that's better for the environment and human health. In the long term, this is a very feasible idea. What do you think about that?
Well, when you said bread makers, I was imagining actually somebody who makes bread, and so then I was imagining somebody on your counter who makes bread and then the meat maker.
Next to a meat maker, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have to look in my back issues of Tissue Engineering because I think I skipped that article.
All about the story. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. I wanted to quickly thank Rick as well for teching for us today. And I'm going to now read the official statement put out by the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition. They were so kind to put together a statement for us about the Calgary Stampede and their perspective on it. And I really wanted to feature their view because the stampede is still going on and there's just so many different difficult issues that are raised through this particular event. So I'm going to read it, and then we're going to go to our interview with Patrick Kwan and Sheila Hamanica, and we're going to be talking about racism in the animal rights movement. But first, the press release. It's called The Calgary Stampede and All Its Trimmings. Calgary as a city has been growing at an incredible rate, reaching approximately 1 million citizens now, with no likelihood that the growth will be slowing in the foreseeable future. As a result of that, there's a strange mix of peoples and attitudes here, with those who believe and aspire to see Calgary as a cosmopolitan city, with the resultant enlightened views and lifestyles. There are others who, while desiring that, still choose to cling to a Western flavor, complete with the annual spectacle known as the Calgary Stampede, the self-proclaimed, quote, greatest outdoor show on earth, unquote. Truly, a city of such diverging perspectives needs to make a decision, to either remain as insular, backwater town, or to become a vibrant and contemporary city that reflects the growing awareness of its people and of humanity in general. The Calgary Stampede was the dream of an American entrepreneur who saw Calgary as the perfect location for his vision of Wild Bill Hickok's Wild West show, complete with Indians and cowboys, animal tricks, and an agricultural fair. Nothing in it was based on a historical precedent, either in the activities that engaged animals, isn't stunt riding, bronco busting, etc. In fact, the Calgary Stampede, in its longevity, created its own history and the precedent that of itself. No one on a ranch treated its animals in the fashion that the rodeo did, with the roping and the wrestling, the riding of bulls, and enraged horses. They still don't, as indicated by ranchmen I've spoken to over the years of our protesting the Stampede Rodeo. In fact, for all the opposition we may hold towards all animal industries, there are still very strong views within the agricultural community opposing rodeos. We have been fortunate as an animal rights group to have been given information on what occurs behind the scenes, both in the rodeo and with the other spectacle of animal abuse, the chuck wagon races, with people in the opposing camps volunteering the facts and behind-the-scenes information. No matter how you view it, the facts are brutal, and the animals are made to suffer. Calf roping caused tears in the neck musculature, crushed trachea, broken ribs, and more. Calves are encouraged to run out of the chute through some tail twisting. So far on the first day of this year's stampede, one of the calves had its neck broken. Bull riding and bronco busting occur through the inducement of these animals to buck and twist their bodies in a desperate attempt to unseat the irritant on its back through the use of handheld cattle prods and hot shots that cause an intense pain as the electricity zaps it just prior to the chute opening for it to go rushing out. Injuries include the hyperextending of their backs, broken bones and limbs, dislocations, etc., including a few years ago during the finals, a moment of spectacle watching as the bull somehow got its leg caught in the bars of the chute, causing it to be shattered and the bull having to be, quote, executed behind a screen in front of the audience. One could, in fact, list every event, and with them all the problems that the animals face and the injuries that occur, but time being somewhat limited, we won't do this. Suffice to say, there is much to be condemned within the rodeo industry, and nothing to be applauded. The same applies to the chuck wagon races, where it is not an uncommon thing to learn, in confidence, that certain teams give their horses a mixture of what's known as a milkshake, a sugar and baking soda blend designed to get their hearts to beat faster, with the result being that they run faster, and in doing so cause some of the horses to have heart attacks and die. In 2002, 6 horses died during the chuck, some of them from heart attacks and some from collisions. In 2001, a horse died from a heart attack during the chucks. None of this needs to happen. Rodeo is not a necessary part of the Western heritage, or perhaps more accurately, myth. It is a spectacle, they would call it a sport, that perpetuates the exploitation of non-human animal life and lives at the great cost to them and a tidy profit to the industry. The Calgary Stampede, as a centerpiece to this spectacle, is constantly battling the negative consequences to the continual parade of death that comes out of its chutes and gates. This year, there was a horrific tragedy that occurred fully 1 week prior to the start of the stampede, when a number of horses leapt to their deaths on their way out to being herded into Calgary. It should never have been done, even though it is accepted as having been an accident. It was an accident that should have been avoided by simply recognizing the risks and just not holding this event. The official count of horses dying is at 9, but there are witnesses to the tragedy that are quite certain that, due to the large number of injuries suffered by the horses, as they were trampled on, tripped, etc., the number of dead are greater, perhaps as many as 20. The official spin by the Stampede is that they did everything they could to prevent such an incident, and that their animal safety record speaks well of their commitment to these animals. Naturally, we challenge them on both of these claims. The fact that, even if we use the official accounts as approximated by the Stampede Board, there are approximately 56 deaths of animals from Stampede Rodeo and chuck wagon activities since 1986. As for the accident of last week, allowing the staging of such an event in a city of 1 million people along a major traffic corridor, clearly the best way to have avoided any risk of tragedy would have been to avoid staging it altogether, something they certainly weren't comfortable doing, since they were charging people $15,000 to ride alongside, including such ill-advised luminaries as the former Premier of Ontario, Premier Peterson, and his wife. They, being completely ignorant of animal welfare, were likely told that such things are freak occurrences, and they reacted as they did as a result of that ignorance and the spin they were given. The bottom line here is that the Calgary Stampede's animal-based events are outdated remnants of a past that never was. They are cruel, with horrific consequences awaiting the animals fated to be part of the travesty. The Stampede itself, as a themed annual fair, certainly doesn't require the shame of the exploited and killed animals to bolster its popularity or to lure an audience. In fact, the Stampede has started to give away rodeo tickets for every lottery ticket purchased for its home lottery, something that wouldn't need to be done if the rodeo was popular. As they claim, they wouldn't need to pad their audience with numbers of these freebie tickets, in other words. The writing is on the wall, where the continued increase in animal deaths is making even the most moderate of people uncomfortable with the staging of rodeo events. And at some point, the Stampede will realize too late that the people are just not coming to witness such brutality anymore, to the detriment of the entire fair. We of the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition will continue to speak out loudly against such a horrendous waste of innocent life and lives, and continue to encourage others to do likewise, individually, with us, by boycotting the Stampede through a variety of means at their disposal. On behalf of the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition and all who oppose the rodeo and chuck wagon racing, I thank everyone for their support in their opposing these barbaric events. And that was written by the spokesperson of the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition, Michael Alvarez-Toy.
And to say that, for the Calgary police to say that they cannot press charges because it needs to be a willful act of animal cruelty against these horses is ludicrous, because it's obviously they obviously willfully trekked them across 200 kilometers near all these risks that Michael mentioned in the article. Sure, they tried to keep them from running off a bridge, but how do you keep them from being spooked in this completely unnatural environment? That's pretty willful to me. I think we know who's pulling the strings in that province.
And it's such an uncontrolled environment, too, when you have them outdoors where they're going to be subjected to all different types of things that could spook them. So there's just no really way to control that at all. It's just such a risky situation and so unnecessary, you know?
Completely.
Like, when we talk to people about, you know, so many different issues like animal testing or whatever, a lot of people will counter, well, we need those tests for human health or whatever. But when it's just purely entertainment, it just even seems that much more ridiculous and frivolous, you know?
Isn't it strange? 2005, the 21st century, and yet we're doing this and we're breaking calves' necks and we're spooking horses off bridges. It just seems like we're going to look back on this time and think, wow, by the, in the 21st century, we still were nowhere in terms of this.
And on that note, we're going to take a very short musical break, and then we're going to come back with Sheila Hamanica and Patrick Kwan, and we're going to be talking about racism in the animal rights movement and some practical things that the movement can do to do better outreach and more coalition building with other social justice movements. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I just want to quickly plug our website, animalvoices.ca. We have tons of archived programs there, and if you want to give us any feedback about the site or about the program, you can write us at animalvoices.ca. At CIUT.fm. I'm very pleased to welcome both Sheila Hamanica and Patrick Kwan on the show. Sheila is an anti-racist educator who has studied with the People's Institute, and she's also a member of the Justice and Unity Campaign of WBAI, which is the Pacifica Radio in New York City. And we're going to be talking with her. And she's also a celebrated children's author and illustrator. I got to check out one of her books yesterday, and it was absolutely beautiful. We're also speaking today with Patrick Kwan, who is the founder and executive director of the Student Animal Rights Alliance. Additionally, he has campaigned as a human rights and environmental activist through his past work with Amnesty International. Thank you both very much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Lauren, it's pronounced Hamanaka.
Okay.
And hi, Patrick.
Hi, Sheila. How are you?
Great. You can both hear each other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Super. So tell us about writing the article that you wrote, Sheila, for Satya, on racism and the animal rights movement. Tell us about why you wrote that article.
Well, I had done a workshop at the Grassroots Animal Conference on anti-racism. And Pat Klein, the editor at Satya, asked me to follow it up with an article. And I wrote it because I guess, like a lot of people, I'm sort of frustrated with all the problems in the world, whether they be with animals or racism or the war in Iraq. And I just wanted to make a few points about what I felt was the relationship between racism and political power and the animal rights movement.
And you also spoke with Patrick for that interview as well, for the writing of that article.
Yes. Patrick has an incredible track record. He contributed most of the points on the checklist, which came with the article, about what organizations can do practically to build unity.
So you're someone that's fairly new to the movement, and Patrick, you've been involved for a little bit longer in terms of animal rights activism. Maybe I can get both of your impressions of the animal rights movement at this point and your perspective on racism within the movement. Would you both say that it's a problem and it's prevalent? I know that some people within the movement, white activists, will simply deny that there is any problem or that racism has anything to do with the animal rights movement. I was wondering if you could both respond to that.
Sheila, would you like to go first?
Sure. Well, let's take it from the point of view of somebody looking at the animal rights movement from outside. I think there's sort of stereotypes that develop. I think people that I've talked to will say, you think of the animal rights activist, you see a young, white, middle-class person, and they're really desperate, and they're busting animals out of cages, or they're throwing paint on fur coats. Now, of course, these are stereotypes because the animal protection movement goes much deeper than that, but there is an element of truth to it. But ask your question as to whether people in the movement see it as a problem. So that's how people see it from the outside, okay, as a white movement. But do people within the movement see it as a problem? Well, generally I would say no, even though people want to have diverse movements. And this is true of other movements as well, the environmental movement, the peace movement. Even though they want to have diverse movements, it's not something that they wake up every morning and they say, oh, God, this is like really making me sick. This is awful. This is like segregation from the 1950s. We really have to do something about this. And unless people get to that point where they're emotionally bothered by something and they're kind of angry about it, generally speaking, they're not going to do anything about it unless they're educated to see that it's a real problem that's crippling the movement.
And Patrick, what about you, your perspective on whether or not racism is a problem or is recognized as a problem within the animal rights movement?
Well, I think after the article came out, a few people actually came up and asked me, and Patrick, do you really think the animal rights movement is racist? Well, of course, the animal rights movement as a community is not racist. I mean, just like how you cannot say a city in New York is racist, but does racism exist in New York City, for example? And does racism exist in the animal rights movement? And the answer to both is yes. And I think that's what Sheila and I are here to talk about, that racism does exist in the animal rights movement, just like it exists in New York City or any other community, and we as a movement have to come together and address the issue. And also, you know, it's also about building diversity. And I think in the article, in the Sasha article that Sheila wrote, she interviewed, you know, Patrice Jones from the Eastern Shore Bird Sanctuary and, you know, at the Chicken Sanctuary. And she actually made a really great point that having a diverse movement is not just about having a rainbow coalition just so you can have one person of this color here, one person of this color there. It's really about building a really strong and diverse movement that can help us address all the issues that are here for the animals. And I think a lot of it is just like we know that many people, especially with Eastern religions, happen to be vegetarians. But when you look around at, for example, a vegetarian conference, more than most likely you will see the conference be overwhelmingly white. And obviously when you look around the animal rights movement, it's also overwhelmingly white. And there's actually an activist who actually said, you know, when you look around the animal rights movement, it's perhaps more like an animal rights movement than an animal rights movement. And I think it's about what we are trying to do and really to see it. It's about like almost like an elephant in the room that hasn't really been addressed. It's like, if the animal rights movement is so white, and then a lot of people go like, you know, why do you have to focus on this issue when there's so many issues regarding animals that need to be addressed? And the truth is that if we actually address racism and diversity issues head-on, we'll build a bigger and more diverse movement and a stronger movement to address all the animal protection issues out there.
Patrick, how you said the animal rights movement, you know, is racist. How is that evident? Is it from the people in the animal rights movement who seem to be racist, or is it simply from a lack of people of color within the movement? How is it evident?
Actually, what I meant to say was that, you know, the animal rights movement is as a community is not racist. And okay. what I really, you know, talking about is that does racism exist in the animal rights movement? And the truth is yes. And just like racism exists in New York City, racism exists in Toronto and in different communities. It's about us coming together as a community to address these issues and to build a more diverse movement.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, in terms of my own research on race and animal issues, that there's sort of two different strands that I think need to be addressed. And one is that looking at racism and how it manifests in the movement and how can stronger coalitions be built that move beyond tokenism. So that's sort of one issue. But it's also, I think, part of it is trying to enrich our analysis of how oppression works. I think that some people think that you can liberate animals off the backs of other groups, or that the oppression of animals somehow exists in a vacuum and doesn't relate to other issues of oppression. I was wondering if both of you could talk about some of the ways that you see the movement possibly moving forward in terms of addressing those issues.
I'd like to step back for a moment to the question about racism in the movement.
Sure.
I think there's two issues involved. I mean, one is, what do you mean by racism? A lot of people think that racism means I don't like you because you're black. I don't like you because you're Asian. Or they use the N-word. In other words, that racism equals racial prejudice. I studied with the People's Institute, and their definition of racism is different. They say that racism equals racial prejudice plus power. That power being the operative word. Now, let's take a look at the animal protection movement, which broadens it out from the animal rights movement. My observation, just sort of looking at these huge groups, let's say the Humane Society or the various SPCAs around the country, or maybe even PETA, is that there's a hierarchy. They're organized like corporations. You know, there's the underlings, there's the supervisors, there's the vice presidents, there's the presidents, right? And by and large, they're run by white males. In other words, that structure is inherently racist. It's what's called institutional racism. Now, those people individually might not be prejudiced. In fact, they probably aren't, because most people today in the leadership of liberal organizations are very progressive in their thinking. But they have these jobs, and they're operating within a system that is completely composed of other organizations that are based on institutional racism, and so it's nothing unusual to them, and it's sort of self-perpetuating, because, you know, in order to break into these organizations, you have to have certain credentials, certain, you know, background, education, et cetera, et cetera. And because of the segregation of the animal protection movement, you might not find a lot of people of color who would be able to break into this. And also, with my interviews of people of color who worked in the movement, they've been very discouraged, and some of them have just flat out quit because they can't stand the isolation that they experience from being the only person of color within these organizations, or not having the problem taken seriously enough, being treated as window dressing, et cetera, et cetera. So is there racism in the animal rights movement? Yes, there is.
I want to make sure that I'm not closing off. Patrick, if you wanted to contribute something.
Well, it's also, I think, one of the things that I remember, something that's been talked about maybe as a joke and also in some way, that people are saying, you know what, there's a preconception that people of color don't care about animals. And I think the interesting thing is that poll after poll and survey after survey has shown that it's actually the opposite is true. I think PETA actually a few years ago came out with a survey that showed that as many as two-thirds of blacks and 51% of Hispanics and 45% of whites say that they are more likely to give up meat and dairy products after hearing that eating meat is linked to diseases and other health ailments. And also, an overwhelming 86%, and we're talking about 86% of Hispanic women and youth, 18 to 29, are the strongest supporters of the laws to ensure humane treatment of animals raised for food. And blacks who live in the West, 78%, and African-American women, 70%, are very likely to say that they support enactment of humane laws. Then also there are other polls. For example, there was a survey done by the University of Michigan also about 2 years ago that showed that African-Americans are more likely to give up meat after hearing about the environmental impacts of meat eating than whites are. like I mentioned also before, that vegetarianism has a very deep root in the Asian community, in the African community, and when we look around, that, you know, there's people who are people of color who do care about animals, and while, you know, when we looked around, that there aren't really that many people of color in the movement. And one, I think, is the preconception that, you know, people of color don't care about animals. And then second is that even people of color care about animals, that they have their own issues to work on, that they won't be working on animal issues. And that's like a, you know, a barrier that we as a movement have not really been able to break or address, and thereby it's actually preventing us from having more people in the movement. And I think it's about, there's a bigger issue of, like Sheila has mentioned very eloquently, about, you know, the issue of institutional racism. And there's also, like, how are we working and what are we doing to build diversity in the movement? And I think it's sadly that, you know, when you look around the movement, that I've always been interested in seeing the big organizations, if there are literature available in English other than language. And I think we understand that, especially in the United States, in North America in general, that English is not the only language spoken in the United States. And then, however, a lot of the big organizations who really have the resources to print literature and to have websites in other languages are not doing so. And the only group that I know of that actually has website and have, like, plenty of literature available in Spanish is actually CETA. But then, as we all know, that there are other animal protection groups out there, too. And people go, like, well, you know, we don't have anyone who speaks Spanish, who speaks Chinese, or who speaks whatever other language, and I can't do diversity issues. And I go, like, you know what? There happen to be a lot of people of color who also speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that, you know, we're not doing that either to really, like, outreach to people of color communities. And we as a movement, I think we've actually been failing at that.
Sheila, you had mentioned about how people don't necessarily take the issue seriously. And Patrick, you've just mentioned some of the things that people can do within the movement to address racism. And you mentioned both providing materials in a variety of languages. And I was wondering if you could both speak about some of the ways that the movement, other ways that the movement can take this issue seriously and what that would look like.
First of all, let me refer your listeners to the article, because there's a pretty good checklist at the end of it. I hope it's online.
Yep.
I think it's satyamag.com.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We have it linked on our website as well for people.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's really good. I think the first thing people need to do is study racism. I happen to have studied with the People's Institute because I'm preparing a program about them for the radio. And so I went to the workshop once. You know, it's really nice. They offer it here in my county, and the county actually subsidizes the training, so it's very reasonable. But I went once, and then because I was doing the program, I went another four times. And at first I thought, oh, well, you know, this is just like ideas, and they're really good, and okay, I've heard them once. You know, great. But I found that after going four more times, that each time I was going, I was learning something more. And it's kind of an interesting process. It's not just a matter of learning ideas like what is racism, what is the structure of it, how is it built into our society, what steps can we take to work against it. But it's actually building a kind of an internal strength. I mean, this is speaking from the position of a person of color, right? It's kind of crazy-making being a person of color in a dominant white society, because your ideas and your perceptions they tend to be marginalized. Like, you have this issue. You are kind of angry. And I even got this from some of my friends, you know. You're really kind of angry. I think you should tone down this article. And in reality, if you're a person of color and you're not angry, you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're depressed. Or you're going to jump off a bridge or something. You know, you're going to do something crazy. But whatever it is, you're not going to live up to your full potential. And so getting involved in anti-racism training is very, I don't want to use the word therapeutic, it's kind of limited, but it really opens you up to the idea that this is something serious. You have to take this seriously. When you ignore people of color, when you minimize them, when you don't acknowledge their existence, you're really harming people. There is a dynamic that's going on, and you're part of it. And you have to be aware of that. And suddenly, when you open these doors and you start talking about it, and it might be uncomfortable to talk about it, the enrichment, the things that you get out of it in exchange, are so much more valuable. But it's very complicated. I'm like 55, right? I've spent my entire life growing up in a racist society. I grew up with books like The Five Chinese Brothers, you know, Little Sambo, etc. etc., right? Like really, really, really overt racism. Dick and Jane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, we expect that we're going to have Humane Society and PETA and all these groups are going to have a conference. And there's going to be one session that's going to last for an hour, and we're going to talk about racism, and that'll just about do it. Well, that's not the case, because we've spent years being involved in this very complicated, very deep issue. And so to undo it really requires comprehensive training. So although I say talk about it, I really mean study it, and you have to be trained. You have to go to professionals in a way. I mean, that's just... that's just the nature and organization of our society right now. You have to go to people who know the history of the movement, the politics, and the nature of racism, and then get into it in a prolonged and protracted way.
I think it's interesting because it seems like some people that I talk to, and I've heard this in so many different movements too, that get single issued that, you know, well, racism really isn't my issue, you know, like I study, you know, X, Y, or Z, and that by denying that it's their responsibility, then it just seems that they perpetuate it on an unconscious level, because I think, Sheila, as you'd mentioned before, people will think, well, I'm a good person, you know, I try to treat people equally, end of story.
And I think it really reminds me that before I founded the Human Animal Rights Alliance, I actually was a field organizer for Amnesty International for the Human Rights and the Environment program. And I think at that time, people were like, human rights and the environment, you know, you have human rights activists saying that environmentalism is not their issue. And you have environmental activists who say human rights is not the issue. And actually, you know, when Amnesty International and the Sierra Club came together, and they actually found that there happens to be, a lot of people know that there are deep connections between human rights and environment issues. And the main issue that actually Amnesty International and Sierra Club found was that the Sierra Club colleagues actually found that the same people who are in Mexico and India and China and Burma who are speaking out on environmental issues, their colleagues, their international colleagues who are trying to make a difference for the environment, these people are actually beaten, raped, and even thrown in jail. And they may actually even be killed. And the thing that I think for that, I think it really is a wake-up call in a way that for us as a movement, I remember Dan Channon, who is the senior campaigner for PETA with their KFC campaign, international campaign against KFC, that the only country where KFC has actually been stepping up and actually earning money and not losing money is China, the country where they are not able to speak out and protest against KFC. And I think for us to understand that in order for you to be able to speak up for the animals, that there's the civil liberties, the human rights issues, and the edges around the world for many activists and, you know, international colleagues in countries, for example, like China, are really unable to speak out. And I think there was a great poll that was available from the Compassion in World Farming talking about, you know, that the international community and their attitude towards animal protection issues is actually equal to or actually higher than Western society. However, the conduct of their government is not necessarily the same as the people. And I think in the United States, we will see that the conduct of our government is not really representative of the people of the United States. And going back to like what we exactly can do, I think one of the things that we really can do is really be able to take responsibility as a movement and as individuals and organizers that, you know, we're going to go out there and it's not just something that we're going to acknowledge as an issue, but really like take responsibility that we have to do something about it and what are we going to do about it. And being able to, like what Sheila talked about, is actually, you know, coming together and talk about it as an issue. It may be uncomfortable, but, you know, let's take responsibility and do something about it.
Patrick, we're going to end there just for a short musical break, and then we'll come back and talk to both of you. This interview was, it sparked my interest in doing this interview with Sheila and Patrick after I read the Satya article written by Sheila with Tracy Basile. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes. Okay.
And it's called Racism in the Animal Rights Movement, and we have a link to that on our website. Stay tuned. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. We are speaking today with Sheila, I'm going to say your name incorrectly again, I'm sure, Hamanaka, and Patrick Kwan about racism in the animal rights movement. And I wanted to check in with you both during our musical interlude, but that didn't happen, about where you'd like to see the rest of the interview go. There's so many different things to talk about. And before the break, we were talking about some of the practical things that people can do to address the movement. And I wanted to open up the floor to both of you if there's something in particular that you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Well, I just wanted to get back to the issues. I think you started talking about it before, Lauren. To me, the word power always comes to mind. I think about there's like 54 billion animals that get slaughtered every year. I mean, that's huge. And the industries that support that are enormous. I mean, it's the meat industry, the whole agribusiness industry. It's all tied in with, it's a whole global operation. It's huge money involved. So you got to think of what are we up against, okay, versus who are we and what do we have on our side, right? And are we effective? Is it working? You know, how many animals did we save today? I think that the movement really has to see itself, as Patrick was talking about before, as part of a global movement. That there is really, take all the people in the United States who are active in the animal rights movement, put them together, and they could probably all fit in one room or one stadium or something. That's really not enough power to do anything. And I think if we want to be effective, we have to start thinking about where is the power in the world. And I think a lot of it is starting, if you look at the world as a whole, in these indigenous and people of color, so-called third world, developing world movements, where people are really suffering. I mean, you have like 2 billion people living on less than $2 a day, another billion living on less than $1 a day. 40% of the world has no electricity. I mean, you're talking about striking poverty and inequality and racism, everything, right? And this is where it's going on. And yet, this movement is really, we're really kind of cut off from that. That, I think, is part of the issue of racism, that you have to see that it's not just you and your great ideas, but it's all those people out there that are actually doing things who are really just as smart, if not smarter than you, and that we can learn a heck of a lot from these movements. And I was talking to Andrew Rowland, who's the vice president of HSUS, and he was saying, well, you know, we're very concerned about factory farms opening up in Brazil and in China. And I know, for example, like in Venezuela, that Chavez is importing chicken from Brazil, which he is making available to people for like 90 cents a piece. Right? So on the one hand, you think, okay, this is part of his movement for equality. But at the same time, you realize that these are probably coming out of factory farms in Brazil. And those factory farms are going to degrade the environment in Brazil. And even though they have a progressive president, there's something really awful that's going on, maybe under the radar, that they're not aware of. Now, has anybody in the animal rights movement even talked to Chavez or to Lula in Brazil? Why not? I mean, I know these are big shots, right? but why aren't we trying to make contact with these people or with the movements in China or Korea or all the other movements around the world? I think we need to reach out and join up with these groups.
So, Sheila, I was going to ask a question about how to remain culturally sensitive to various cultures that use animals to survive while protesting their actions. You know, for example, in Nunavut, you know, polar bears are now a threatened species, but, you know, various hunters make over 50% of their income from hunting polar bears. And you know, a lot of people in the animal rights movement throughout, you know, North America and perhaps the world would protest hunting polar bears in Nunavut, and many might see that as being culturally insensitive and racist against Inuit people. Would you suggest then, you know, in order to try and start some dialogue, talking to, say, the government of Nunavut? I mean, how do we approach that kind of action while being culturally sensitive?
Well, I don't know if Patrick wants to answer that.
One of the things that I've been, a lot of people have been asking me about has been the issue of dog and cat eating in China and
right.
other Asian countries, and that's what I can definitely speak to as an Asian American, and, you know, someone whose family is actually from Hong Kong, from China. They go like, oh, do you want us to not talk about dog eating and cat eating? And I was like, you know what? Actually, I would love for everyone to be talking about dog eating and cat eating, because the thing is that we found, especially when people look at polls and surveys done and public opinion polls that are done in Asia, in the countries and conducted by media in those countries themselves, they found that most of the people there, most of the Asian people in South Korea, in China, in Hong Kong, they do not eat dogs, they do not eat cats. But it's actually been almost like a racist notion that, you know, sure, there are some people who do eat dogs and cats, but do everybody eat it and do most people approve of it? And the answer is no. And the thing is that, you know, for us to really, you know, not to paint it as if, hey, your whole country that, you know, you guys are so backwards that you guys are eating dogs and cats. And in some ways, I mean, I'm sure the people in India look to America the same way for eating cows. And the thing is that, you know, for us to be really be able to, like, talk about the issues and go, like, focus on the issues. And then I think if we do have a diverseness and with a diverse cultural background that we have activists out there, if we're able to bring the dialogue in, I think it would actually be able to make talking about these issues easier. And I think, I remember there were campaigns in San Francisco about the live animal market in Chinatown. And I remember that there were certain activists there who weren't even vegetarians. And I think that is disturbing that there are people who, like, point at these animals in live animal markets, you know, for the Chinatown community, who are killing birds, who are killing frogs, and killing these animals there, and they aren't even vegetarians themselves, and really going like, hey, if you're be able for us to be talk about issues like this, really, you know, we have to look at how animals are treated in different ways. And I think some time ago there was a person who works at a national group who told me, hey, I really can't believe how Asians treat animals. And my response to that is that, you know, at least in a joking way, that at least Asians are in some ways consistent in different ways about all the animals. And I think if we are able to address the issues head on and we are able to be able to tackle these issues easier. And I think one of the things that we have to, you know, bring back to, like, what we can do since I, how much time do we have, by the way?
I was just about to say we have about 3 minutes left, and actually I wanted to make sure, Patrick, that you had a chance to offer some closing thoughts as well. I don't know if this is, you know, where you want to continue going or if there's something else you wanted to share with our listeners before we head off.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, one of the big issues is that we've always recognized in the community that, you know, very basic thing, I think even elementary school students would agree that in order for ecosystems to survive and in order for ecosystems to thrive and really grow, the ecosystem needs to be diverse. It needs to have a lot of diverse creatures and living things in it in order for it to grow and survive and to get stronger. And for some reason, that I think it's the very same thing for communities and for movement. In order for us to grow as a movement, we have to have people diverse, you know, to make up the movement, so it won't be, you know, monogamous and things like that. And I think it's really important that bring back to, like, you know, Sheila talks about, you know, going back to the checklist that's available at drmag.com about where we're holding our events or our meetings held all the time in the very same places that we always hold. Have we actually given up flyers in other neighborhoods? Have we tabled and done events in other neighborhoods? And you can do that. See that there's a very simple thing that we can be doing. And I think I'll share some of my time with Sheila at the very end.
Sheila, are you still on the line?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, you know, perhaps you could get some of the Inuits on the air to discuss this issue. I think your people's concerns about these things are very valid. But, you know, one might say, well, the real threat to polar bears is the destruction of the environment. just like the threat to tigers in India is the destruction of the forest. And these are very complex issues which can only be tackled by groups banding together in a global way because they are so huge. But I think, I hope that we can talk about this again in the future and follow up on some of these very interesting issues. I would say that we have to tackle racism on a day-to-day basis. We have to talk about it. We have to study it. We've got to reach out to communities, as Patrick was saying. I think these big institutions have a huge responsibility to start practicing affirmative action and recruiting heavily amongst people of color. And just, we should have more programs like this.
Great. I wanted to direct people to a couple of interviews that we did if you're interested in looking at some of these issues as a starting point. We did an interview with Rita Laws about vegetarianism and First Nations issues. We've also interviewed people from blackvegetarians.org as well as the founding member of Black Vegetarians in the U.S. And we also spoke with Jennifer Walsh, who talked about colonialism and immigration and anti-immigrant discourses in the animal rights movement. Thank you so much, both of you, for being on the program today. We have a link.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was awesome to have you on. We'd like to have you both on again sometime soon. We have the article Racism in the Animal Rights Movement posted on the link posted on our website, animalvoices.ca, as well as links to the People's Institute and the Student Animal Rights Alliance. Thank you so much for being on the program today, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. You've been listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. Thanks to Rick also for teching for us today, Carl for bringing the noise, and for Rob co-hosting and doing the news today. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.